amid complete blockage of the territory. Meanwhile, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres said on Friday, 14th of October, that the situation in Gaza has reached a dangerous new low after Israel warned 1.1 million residents of northern Gaza to flee south to southern Gaza following days of near-constant airstrikes on the embattled territory. Antonio Guterres said, after days of airstrikes, the Israeli army has ordered the Palestinians in Gaza City and its surroundings to move to the south of the territory. He added, moving more than 1 million people across a densely populated war zone to a place with no food, water or accommodation when the entire territory is under siege is extremely dangerous and in some cases simply not possible. Guterres added, hospitals in south of Gaza are already at capacity and will not be able to accept thousands of new patients from northern Gaza. He added, the health system is on the brink of collapse. Morgues are overflowing. Many healthcare staff have been martyred whilst on duty, and there have been tens of attacks on health facilities in Gaza in the past few days. The United Nations Secretary General called for immediate humanitarian access throughout Gaza so that we can get fuel, food and water to everyone in need. Antonio Guterres added, even wars have rules. International humanitarian law and human rights law must be respected and upheld. Civilians must be protected and never used as shields. Also, United Nations Aid Chief Martin Griffiths said, the order to evacuate 1.1 million people from northern Gaza defies the rules of war and basic humanity. Martin Griffiths added, Gaza is under intense bombardment, roads and homes have been reduced to rubble. There is simply nowhere safe to go in Gaza.
Declassified. Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. In this special edition of Palestine Declassified, we're going to examine the extraordinary armed uprising of the Palestinian people against the Zionist entity, which has repeatedly and flagrantly spurned every single peaceful attempt to secure justice for Palestine. First up is Latifa Abu Chakra with a special report about this audacious military offensive by Palestinian freedom fighters that began in the early hours of Saturday morning on October the 7th.
As fragile as a spider's web, the Zionist entity is shaking with fear. In an early morning shock, Palestinian resistance factions from Gaza launched an unprecedented three-pronged attack on the entity. First, armed fighters sailed over the Israeli fence to Gaza using hand gliders. Simultaneously, 5,000 rockets were launched into the Zionist entity from the open-air prison of Gaza, disabling that much-vaunted Iron Dome system. At the same time, Palestinians broke down the fence, which fighters had sailed over, using bulldozers. What ensued was the homecoming of at least 1,000 Palestinians from the resistance factions into the fragile Zionist entity. Military bases were seized by the resistance, and Israel's Merkava tanks were captured and taken back to Gaza. Settlements like Sderot, whose Zionist guests had previously watched from hilltops while Gaza was bombed, were seized by the resistance. Over 100 settlers have been taken as prisoners of war by the resistance. The vast majority are members of the occupation forces. Some are extremely high-ranking figures, like General Nimrod Aloni, commander of the Depth Corps and former commander of the 143rd Gaza Division. He was unceremoniously marched from his bed in his underwear by the resistance forces. An area of occupied Palestine larger than the Gaza Strip was taken and held by the resistance factions, who reached within only 10 kilometers of the West Bank city of El Khalil, known to settlers as Hebron. It is documented that resistance factions were able to fashion weapons from unexploded munitions dropped on them by the Israelis. But did weapons from NATO escapades in Afghanistan and Ukraine really end up in Gaza? Time will tell. The fear of South Lebanon is palpable among the settlers, so much so that an Israeli occupation unit opened fire on an approaching truck close to Lebanon. They discovered that the vehicle carried 7 Israeli fighters. All had been killed by the Zionist-friendly fire. Overall, in a space of 48 hours, at least 700 settlers were killed. The vast majority were part of the occupation forces. To put the figure into perspective, in proportion to the size of the population of the colony, that is the equivalent of over 20,000 people in the United States. In the midst of it all, Russian hacker group Killnet took down the site of the Israeli regime administration, further spreading panic and fear. Nearly all major stocks in Israel are in the red, with the benchmark index recording the biggest loss for over a year. Poland and Bulgaria have sent military planes to evacuate their citizens and bring them back home to Europe.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest today is Sami Al-Aryan, who is a public affairs professor and a long-standing political activist whose roots are in Palestine. And Sami has vigorously campaigned for Palestinian liberation for many years, and he was blacklisted in the United States because of his political views. And he joins us today via Skype from Istanbul. Welcome to the show. Sami, perhaps we could start with you. Are we witnessing the death spasms of the Zionist idea, do you think?
Well, we have to go back to the origins of Zionism. Zionism was the political movement of Jewish elites at the end of the 19th century, and it was their response to Europe's anti-Semitism that existed at the time, particularly in Russia, the pogroms, and continued to what the experts would call the Jewish question. And they tried to answer that by basically creating an exclusivist, settler, colonial, racist state that has been trying for over a century to uproot the native people of Palestine from their native land and try to replace them with Jews around the world. This is what Zionism is about, and I think it has failed, but it continues to be strong in terms of the state because of the support it has been receiving from mainly Western governments, particularly the United States. But I think now it's becoming very clear that kind of response would not be accepted in the 21st century, particularly with the steadfastness of the Palestinians and the resistance to this racist, exclusivist movement and entity.
No, indeed. I mean, David, do you think Israel was caught completely unawares by this operation?
It does seem so. I mean, there's been some reporting, hasn't there, that the Egyptian intelligence services said something was going to happen, but they were ignored. So, I mean, I've seen the various other theories, let's not title them conspiracy theories, that have said that this is a false flag, that the Zionists let it happen, let all these hundreds of people be killed, or they thought that maybe a lesser number would be killed. But no, it's clear that that's not what's happened. What's happened clearly has been an operation planned for many, many months in Gaza and with the other resistance factions across the territories. And it's taken them entirely by surprise, but also, more importantly, it has inflicted an extremely significant military, intelligence, and psychological defeat on the Zionists. Indeed. They didn't think that this could ever happen to them. Mm. And the fact that they've had to evacuate people, thousands and thousands of people, from all of the settlements around Gaza, and indeed they're talking about evacuating all the settlements near the northern border should Hezbollah enter the conflict much more significantly than they have so far. So we're seeing a defeat for Zionism and a crisis for them, really, because they're facing a real difficulty now of the possibility of the end of the Zionist entity.
Indeed, and people queuing up at the airport, weren't they, to actually leave Israel.
To be evacuated, yes. So
there's indeed some prominent figures, actually, in the Zionist entity, as well as I understand it. But, Sami, what's the significance, would you say, of resistance factions capturing General Nimrod Aloni, do you think?
It's quite significant. Yeah, we're going to understand that this is the first time in over 50 years where a senior military leader is in the hands of the resistance movements, in the hands of the Palestinians. He would be a huge bargaining chip in order to get over 5,000 Palestinians who have been languishing in Israeli jails for years. Over 200 of them have prison sentences up to life or life sentences. Therefore, he would be a huge bargaining chip against the Israeli government in trying to free and also to get much of the Israeli plans, and he would be certainly interrogated. And much of what Israel is planning for the Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, will be they'll be able to get it out of them.
Yes, indeed. David, I wonder if you could say a word or two as well about the conditions that people in Gaza have been living in over the years.
Well, people know the phrase, don't they? This is an open air prison.
Indeed.
And of course, there's been an attempt by the Zionists in the last week or so, 10 days, to say, oh, no, it's not occupied. Look, we left Gaza in 2005. This is not an occupation. But, of course, it's entirely surrounded. It's surveilled 24 hours a day. And it underlines the scale of the achievement that the resistance could undermine all of that. But this is an open-air prison. And they've even in the last few days, intensified the siege. No water, no electricity, nothing is going in or out. And they've even closed the Rafah crossing into Egypt, despite saying to people in Gaza, you must leave. The Rafah crossing is open. It's not anymore, and they're talking about bombing that as well.
Indeed.
So this is an open prison that has been for many years. Most of the water in Gaza is not drinkable. There are shortages of everything, including medicines. There are food problems. It's been bombed so many times that there's so much rubble there that they've had to actually start to use the rubble in ingenious ways to build new buildings. So it's an appalling state. Yeah. So it's the worst place in the world under constant military supervision and, yes, occupation by the Israelis.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you say that obviously it's well known that it's an open-air prison, and yet, you know, the corporate media, if you actually read the corporate media or listen to the broadcast channels of the corporate media, they don't really talk about it in those terms, do they?
Well, thankfully, I don't depend on the corporate media for
no, no, my reporting.
Although, of course,
but a lot of people
many people still do. Yes, that's true. Although, of course, many, many more in the last 20 years have turned off from that. But yes,
true.
The corporate media presents a systematically distorted and skewed view and version of what's happening. Although, on the question of occupation, the Zionists have been complaining in the last little while about CBC, the Canadian broadcasters, saying that journalists should not use the word should use the word occupation because it still is an occupation. So that's even the mainstream media won't go as far to what should we call it, to kind of fantasy land as the Zionists want them to.
No, indeed. But Sammy, I mean, in what way would you say is this war different from previous wars on Gaza?
It's quite different. I mean, if you look at the previous four or five wars starting from 2008, 2009, all of them were initiated by the Zionist state. This time it was different. It was surprising. It was the, you're describing as an open-air prison. It was basically a prison break, where the Palestinians themselves took the initiative and attacked, and always you have that benefit of the surprise, and therefore what happened, what ensued after that was huge success, huge victory for the resistance. They were able to actually dismantle this myth of the invincibility of the Israeli army, that this is not an invincible army, but in fact it's an army that was caught flat-footed, and they were shown by few fighters. I mean, these fighters were basically not a regular army. These are mostly volunteers, Palestinian resistors, but they're determined, and they have the will to fight until they gain their freedom and independence and liberation. And we've seen in the first 60 hours how they were going, attacking the military bases, the settlers, the settlements. They were bringing back all kinds of prisoners of war in order to force the exchange and free their comrades in prisons.
Yeah. I mean, David, it said that I think it was 11 U.S. citizens were killed in the operation. I mean, what do you think explains, you know, so many foreign nationals being present in Palestine?
And there's been a British person being confirmed now as being killed over the weekend. Well, what explains this, of course, is something quite different to the explanation about civilians or American citizens or British citizens even being killed in Ukraine, because they are, everybody understands, they are mercenaries. But here, these people are either settlers or they're actually involved directly in being enrolled in what's called the Israel Defense Forces, the Israel occupation forces. Like the British guy, for example, 19 or 20 years old, was actually in the IDF.
Yes.
Now this is about British citizens as foreign fighters.
Yes,
you know, we call these people foreign fighters if they were in Syria or somewhere else, but we don't call them foreign fighters in this case. And of course, when those people who regularly go from Britain or from the US to join the oppressive forces of Israel come back, they're not interrogated as being terrorists. They're not interrogated and asked for why they've got involved in armed violence and killing of civilians. And actually, you know, in the structural violations of international law, which Israel day by day is committing. And so there's a real question here about how we actually change the way in which our society works so that people from the UK are not allowed to go to fight for Israel.
No, indeed. I mean, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, was saying, you know, our thoughts are with the British citizen who was killed. But surely the question should be, why are British citizens serving in the Israeli occupation forces? But we'll just pause there for a moment because we've got another report now looking at the strategic implications for the United States and Israel as a result of the military operation by the Palestinian resistant factions.
As the Palestinian resistance factions prepared for their operation early on Saturday morning, they must have known they were about to embark on what will surely be seen as the most historic mission of any Palestinian resistance fighters. They broke out of the open-air prison of Gaza for the first time since Gaza was occupied in 1967. Of course, the Zionist regime has answered the challenge with a bloody onslaught on civilians, killing more than 100 children in little over a day. They deliberately and openly targeted civilian infrastructure in a frenzy of revenge that hides the strategic vacuum. They've diverted personnel from the West Bank and have laid siege to Gaza. Nothing can go in or out. But the chess game can easily end in an existential threat. Never has the idea that Israel is a temporary entity been so palpable. The United States has issued bellicose warnings and says it is moving forces closer to the entity, but this has drawn fiery riposte from the resistance axis, from Hezbollah, and from the Iraqi resistance, making it plain that escalation means that U.S. personnel will be legitimate targets across the whole region. President Joe Biden gave a nod to the difficulties faced by the much-vaunted U.S. hegemon when he warned supporters of the Palestinians not to take advantage of the circumstances. He didn't say it, but the circumstances are a decline of U.S. power, a notable shortage of U.S. weaponry, which has been effectively destroyed in Ukraine. A little-known U.S. stockpile of ammunition held in Israel has been depleted by supplies in Ukraine. Current Pentagon plans to increase production will not even keep pace with the 6,000 shells expended each day by the Ukrainians. The entry of Hezbollah into conflict from the north is an indication of the strategic vice that Israel finds itself in. By Monday, Zionist radar station was decommissioned and the border fence at the northern border with Lebanon was blown up. Any ground war in Gaza will face stiff resistance, and there will be many more occupation force casualties. Does the entity have the appetite for this? And will it mean the foundations of Zionism begin to crumble? Since the beginning, the security of the Zionist entity has depended on having enough Jewish citizens to win the demographic struggles against the Palestinians. With so many settlers fleeing from the airports and settlers from Poland and Bulgaria being evacuated, how long before the entity crumbles and the dismantling of Zionism begins in earnest? If the special military operation in Ukraine was the first act of the age of multipolarity, the prison bust from Gaza is the opening of the second act. The future is unwritten.
Sammy, your family was expelled from Palestine in 1948, wasn't it? I mean, can you tell us about how you responded to the Gaza breakout over the weekend?
I mean, generations of Palestinians had their hope, the hope of the return to their ancestors' lands. My grandfather and my father, who both passed away years ago, had that hope. It was not fulfilled. I have that hope, which I hope that it would be fulfilled during my lifetime, but if not, certainly my children would have that hope. What we witnessed this weekend was that this is possible, that this myth that the Palestinians would forget over generations, that the old would die and the new would forget, is just a myth, is not true. The fact of the matter is that millions of Palestinians outside Palestine, inside Palestine, yearn to the time where we would enter Palestine and be in that land again. You know, this notion of two state, one state solutions, where it will basically exclude millions of Palestinians from going back, is not going to succeed. I think our goal, our objective should be the dismantlement of the Zionist state because of its racist, exclusivist, colonial structure, that this is an apartheid system that cannot survive the change in this world. And therefore, when this crumbles, and we have seen a glimpse of how could that be, when that happens, then we could truly then talk about peace and talk about harmony and solve, by the way, the Jewish problem, because Zionism redefined Judaism, and I think we need to save Judaism from the evil and from the ideology of Zionism.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. David, I mean, would you say that this was an explosion of anger from Gaza in response to the endless provocations from the Zionist entity, or do you think there's something more strategic going on here?
Well, it would be no surprise to say that people in Gaza are a little bit angry.
Indeed.
With the Zionists. But this is not some spasm, some emotional outburst. This has been planned for a long, long time, at least a year, it seems, that Hamas and the other resistance factions, who we don't talk about enough,
indeed.
People talk about this being Hamas indeed. Doing this or Hamas doing that.
But
it's Hamas,
it's
yes.
Yes.
It's the Palestinian Islamic Jihad.
Yes.
It's the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine.
Indeed.
The Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine were involved. And indeed, even armed groups, the armed wing of Fatah, have been involved in some of these actions,
sure.
Not to mention the various factions across the West Bank. So this is a thing which has been in planning for at least a year and is a strategic activity. So it's not as if this is over. There are other sorts of things which are going to fall into place. We've seen already from the north Hezbollah and to some extent other factions like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in Lebanon making a breach of the fence at the border. This is a strategic thing, and there are all sorts of structural questions in this chess game about who next comes into the frame. And that's what we have to see. That's what the future tells us here. This is not going to be something where the Zionists can just crush the resistance, because there are all sorts of consequences for their actions.
Yes, yes, indeed. Of course, you know, the focus just being on Hamas by the corporate media is another example, I suppose, of the misreporting by the mainstream press and broadcast media. But Sami, what do you think the strategy of the resistance factions is?
Well, I don't think there is any illusion among the resistance fighters that this was a war of liberation. I think they had several objectives in mind, five in particular. The first one would be to stop this daily encroachment, incursion, desecration of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the holy places that have been taking place throughout the year, particularly in the last 3 weeks. Secondly, it was an attempt also to stop the incursion and the daily attacks on Palestinian youth in different West Bank cities, killing them, imprisoning them, detaining them, kidnapping them, which has also claimed over 240 lives this year in the West Bank alone. 40 of them are children. Third, it was an attempt also to, because Israel has been refusing to exchange its prisoners for the few prisoners in Gaza. So there was an attempt to basically get more prisoners of war to force Israel to make that, since 5,500 Palestinians, including many women and children, in prison, and their lives have been even made much worse when Ben Gafir became the person in charge of the prison system. And fourth, it is to lift the siege on the 16-year blockade and siege against Gaza. Over 2 million people have been under siege now without the word really caring or given much attention to this tragedy, to this genocidal policy. And fifth and last, which is very important, is to show the world that the Palestinians are determined and resolved to continue fighting and resisting the occupation, including fighting, but also including to show the world that they are capable of defeating an enemy on the ground. And I call also that our fight is not just militarily, that we need to engage the Zionist groups and Zionist ideology and Zionist supporters and governments, those who support it, on all fields, politically, economically, commercially, legally, human rights, artistically, media-wise, in all spheres, in all geographies.
Yes, indeed. But David, I mean, what do you make of the response of the remainder of the resistance axis? Do you think that will deter the Zionists?
Well, I think people need to understand that the resistance axis is an actual thing, that the resistance in Lebanon, the Hezbollah, in Syria, in Iraq, in Yemen, the Ansarawa in Yemen, and, of course, the Islamic Republic of Iran, this is an actual functioning set of organizations who work together. They don't plan each other's activities, but they are coordinating each with each other. And that's the key to this, is that yes. If there is an escalation from the Americans, the resistance in Hezbollah, in Iraq, have said that they will regard U.S. targets across the region as legitimate. Now, that is a big question. What does that mean in terms of wider conflagration? It's also a question about what happens if there is a ground invasion of Gaza. If there's a ground invasion, the IDF, the Israeli occupation forces, will take very, very heavy casualties. And it will also mean a massive escalation. Hezbollah will almost certainly come in from the north. And, and that, of course, is something which will be concentrating the minds of Netanyahu and his cabinet about how far they can go to pursue their goals of eliminating and expelling all Palestinians.
Sure, yeah, well, that's it, I'm afraid, for another show today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Sami Al-Arian, and, of course, our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Palestine Declassified will be back next week with more forensic investigations and analysis. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shatayeh has slammed the genocide of the people trapped in the besieged Gaza Strip by the Zionist regime. Shatayeh said, speaking at a press conference in Ramallah recently, "Our people in Gaza are going through genocide, and Gaza has become a disaster area." Shatayeh said the world should take a clear stand against the regime to stop its doctrine of killing, burning, erasure and genocide of the Palestinians. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to RT, UN human rights experts warned recently Palestinians in Gaza face mass ethnic cleansing as Israel orders half the population of the densely populated strip to evacuate amid continued aerial bombardment and dwindling resources on the ground. UN Special Rapporteur Francesca Albani said, "In the name of self-defense, Israel is seeking to justify what would amount to ethnic cleansing, noting that Israel has already carried out mass ethnic cleansing of Palestinians under the fog of war." She warned there is a grave danger that what we are witnessing may be a repeat of the 1948 Nakba and the 1967 Naksa, yet on a larger scale. Referring to the Zionist regime's mass expulsions of at least 1 million Palestinians from their homes and land in 1947 to 48 and 1967. She added, the international community must do everything to stop this from happening again. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warned recently that its shelters in Gaza are not safe anymore, adding that the area's 2.3 million residents were rapidly running out of water. The Zionist regime shut off electricity to Gaza following the Hamas attack, recently compounding the humanitarian crisis in the territory, which has been under an illegal blockade since 2007. According to the Electronic Intifada, UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, said that it would not evacuate its schools in northern Gaza being used as shelters for displaced people. More than 170,000 people were sheltering in UNRWA shelters in the area under the evacuation order, an agency spokesperson told the media. We are extremely worried indeed about the safety and security of over 1 million people who are in North Gaza right now. The agency's Commissioner General Philip Lazzarini warned that the forced evacuation will only lead to unprecedented levels of misery and further push people in Gaza into the abyss. UNRWA said that the scale and speed of the unfolding humanitarian crisis is bone-chilling. Gaza is fast becoming a hellhole and is on the brink of collapse. The Electronic Intifada added, Palestinian human rights groups also widely employed the language of genocide for the first time on Friday, October 13th. Brad Parker from Defense for Children International Palestine said, Israeli officials' statements combined with widespread and systematic attacks carried out by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip raise extreme concern that this is now a campaign of genocide against the Palestinian people. Parker added, Israeli military assaults have reached an intensity where they are seemingly intended to deliberately kill large numbers of Palestinians in Gaza, and combined with Israeli total closure policies, show the aim is to destroy Palestinian life in Gaza. Ayad Abu Akhtesh, a program director with Defense for Children International Palestine, said, The international community, led by the U.S. and European Union, are actively enabling the Israeli military to carry out a second Nakba and eradicate the Palestinian people. Genocide is one of the most serious crimes under international law and can result from killing or by creating conditions of life that are so unbearable it brings about the group's destruction, the rights group said. The Zionist regime military and political leaders made additional statements declaring their intent to perpetrate genocide in Gaza. Meanwhile, RT reported a Reuters videographer has been killed in southern Lebanon by the Zionist regime forces. Al Jazeera and Lebanese security sources said six other journalists were injured in the incident. The group was hit by Israeli regime artillery. Reuters said in a statement, We are deeply saddened to learn that our videographer, Essam Abdullah, has been killed. Abdullah was providing a live video feed from near the Israeli regime border. At the time of his death, the agency continued, adding that it is urgently seeking more information from authorities in the region. Reuters journalist Tayer al-Sudani and Maher Nazeh were wounded in the same incident, while Al Jazeera's Ili Brachia and Carmen Jodadar and Agence France-Presse Christina Ossi and Dylan Collins were also injured. It is unclear whether all six were hit by the same shell or by different projectiles of the Zionist regime. A Lebanese security source told AFP that the Zionist regime forces were responsible and Al Jazeera blamed the incident on Israeli bombing. Around the time of the incident, the Zionist regime forces IDF said that its troops were responding with tank and artillery fire to shooting from Lebanese territory. Recently, the IDF said that an explosion had occurred at a barrier along the border near Alma al-Shab, a Lebanese village where the news crews were reporting from. The IDF said its forces responded to the explosion with artillery fire. Abdullah's death brings the number of journalists killed since the start of the conflict on Saturday, October 7th, to 11, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists. Of the 10, 9 died in the Zionist regime airstrikes on Gaza, while one Israeli photographer was killed at Khabuz Nahalos in southern occupied territories. Economic divide.
When it comes to the auto workers' strike in the U.S., there are many things the general public just doesn't know. This was about a broken promise and about sacrifice by the workers and the government. But the workers got the cold end of the stick from the manufacturers. Then the contagion, where there are strikes in many different sectors now in the U.S. All of that is coming up. First, let's take a look at some of the highlights that we'll be covering for you. First, the U.S. auto worker strike. It's a strike over pay, a strike over benefits. CEO pay at the Big Three has increased by 40%. That's one of the reasons why these auto workers are angry. And, of course, they have every reason to be, because overall, another one of the highlights we'll be looking at are the U.S. wages. Now, in terms of the increase there, the top 1%, 145%. The bottom 90%, only 16%. That's a great recipe for inequality for a country. And finally, U.S. strikes. These strikes are not just about the auto workers. There are sectors like hospitality, dining, and healthcare that are also experiencing strikes, which puts into question the health of the U.S. economy.
The U.S. is facing multiple strikes and industrial actions against the backdrop of an uncertain economic time. Thousands of workers have gone on a strike in different industries in recent months to demand higher pay and improved benefits and working conditions. The auto workers are taking aim at CEOs at Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis, who have received a 40% wage increase. Workers also believe they have more bargaining power due to a tight labor market. When it comes to the Hollywood strike, a tentative deal was reached with studio bosses to end a strike that lasted nearly 5 months. Writers began the strike on May 2nd, asking for increased royalties, mandatory staffing of TV writing rooms, and safeguards to their jobs from the use of artificial intelligence.
No matter how advanced AI is, they cannot replicate human emotions. They'll never be able to replicate human connection. And that's the reason why we have the passion for telling stories and why we make movies. So I'm hoping that everyone will come on board with us and stand against this, because there's nothing that can replace, technology can never replace true artistry.
Approval of labor unions is also at its highest point since the year 1965. The majority of the public, 71% of Americans, see unions as key in improving pay and working conditions. The number of workers involved in major work stoppages has hit the highest levels in decades. The number of workers who went on a strike grew by 50% in 2022. Furthermore, between 1979 and 2022, the inflation-adjusted annual wages of the top 1% of workers rose by 145%, while the average annual wages of the bottom 90% rose by only 16%.
Time to take a look at some of the online posts on this. First up, what was posted on X, as it's called now. It said the deal was UAW members take some short-term cuts for the long-term survival of Ford, GM, and Chrysler. That's the promise we made, and that's the promise that was broken. All right, that shows, obviously, how they were chipped out of what was supposed to be coming to them. Next up, a website we referred to where it said more big strikes loom with thousands of healthcare and casino workers set to walk off the job. Well, guess what? When we had this entry, that already has happened. This entry said there is a feeling that the system is fundamentally unfair to the workforce that is doing all the hard work. Went on to say, what is driving the protest? Declining real wages, a tight labor market, and robust corporate profits only bolsters the case for workers. Next, the website where it talked about the largest healthcare strike in U.S. history, the Coalition of Kaiser Permanente Unions, to have accused Kaiser of negotiating in bad faith and committing unfair labor practices. Then a tweet on this on X, solidarity forever with the 75,000 workers at Kaiser Permanente. When you win this fight, the entire working class will win as well. Yeah, again, the Kaiser Permanente took us by surprise because that's the largest of its kind in the U.S. Hopefully we can maybe do a program on that. Well, let me introduce our guests for our first Q&A. We have Daryl Mitchell joining us. Now, Daryl Mitchell is a retired auto worker. He worked at Chrysler Motors. He's a former union representative. And he's an activist in the socialist movement for 50 years, a rather long resume. Former editor at Southern Advocate. He's a founding member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers of Detroit and also a former executive board member at Detroit's Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. Daryl Mitchell, welcome to the program. All right, so let's start off by asking you about this strike. So in one respect, it's about the pay. We know that. But there are things that have really angered these strikers. For example, the CEO compensation that these the big three automakers and their CEOs are making, which has grown, by the way, 40% over the last 4 years. And they're using that to press for their wage increases. Are the workers justified to use that channel in order to get a pay increase for themselves?
I think you're posing it incorrectly. The union has made it clear that one of its key demands is to end the two-tier system. They made this clear at every juncture. Yes, pay is important. Yes, it is important to contrast compensation of auto workers with compensations with CEO. There's nothing rational about paying CEOs billions of dollars for a company being successful, but suppressing the wages of workers. That's my first point. The second point is that all the workers are fighting a battle for their existence. For instance, currently Stellantis has roughly 58,000 employees in the U.S. That's Chrysler. When I was hired in Chrysler Motors, it was 120,000 union members. Over the next 10 years, we are looking at the elimination of roughly 50 to 70% of the auto workforce by digital process and advanced robotics. In my view, this is a last-ditch fight of the auto workers union.
Well, that's a great point that he makes there, which is something that's probably at the forefront of the auto sector overall when it became automated. Diane Feely, let me introduce her. She's a retired auto worker and a member of the UAW Local 22, who joins us. Diane Feely, welcome to Economic Divide. The general trend in the U.S. Based on wages is that we're looking at an inflation-adjusted annual increase, the top 1%, 145%, the bottom 90%, only 16%, which is about a tenth as fast. Why is that happening? Why is such unfairness and basically inequality as a result of this that these uneven wages create?
Yes, I would say so. And it's a combination of the corporations and the government laws that allow them to restructure on the backs of workers. Right now, for example, companies are building new battery plants, and the government has given them millions of dollars, probably about $140 million. But there are no guarantees in what is being given or loaned by the government to these factories and to the corporations of these factories to insist that there be adequate working conditions for the workforce there. So the restructuring that occurred in the 1979-81 period was sort of the beginning of the restructuring. But since then, there have been probably three waves of restructuring, and workers are always expected to give back, when in fact we had nothing to do with the corporate decisions that were made, not only paying the corporate CEOs huge salaries and benefits, but also buying back stock so that that would elevate what their company was worth.
Financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
The U.S. auto workers' strike, which is still ongoing as of now, at least up to now, is reflective of not just payback time, but also of Wall Street greed. That's right. The manufacturers who were bailed out by U.S. taxpayers' money are not willing to give those very same taxpayers the wages that they deserve, while the CEOs were raking in tens of millions of dollars in their salaries. All right. We're going to get into that. But this first section is all about what we're going to cover in this section, because there's a lot of them. First thing we're going to cover is about the strikes themselves, what it has entailed. Then we're going to talk about the progress that they have made, or maybe lack of it, based on what you're going to hear in a matter of minutes. Then the number of workers that are involved, and we're going to put that in a comparative study for you. Next up, the big three profits, big three being the auto manufacturers. Okay, we have to find out how much money they are making. Then we move on to profits and losses. Profits and losses based on when the strikes happened, how much the manufacturers have made or lost. The wage growth, that's very important because of the comparison we're going to make to, for example, the CEOs. And we're going to take a look at the salaries that some of the CEOs of these manufacturers are making. And finally, car sales in the scope of how much the gross amount of sales these manufacturers have in their market, which is very important. So let's get going. All right, the first category that we have for you are the strikes themselves. With the strike and entails walkouts so far, GM and Stellantis, those two manufacturers, you have five assembly plants that have gone on a strike. They're not operational. You have 38 parts depots also, cumulatively speaking, that are not functional. This shows that this strike has the potential for it to actually expand, okay? Next, it's pretty simple.
The union demand is 40%. That's the increase they want for their pay. But the car makers are only willing to go up to 20%. The latest has indicated that this figure has gone down to 36%, but we're not sure because it's not confirmed. In Canada, they gave up a whole lot more than that. Let's move on to the next category in terms of the number of workers. This is important. In the year 2021, you had 36,600 that went on a strike. In the year 2023, 362,000 have gone on a strike. Now, if you're going to add the number of auto workers, which combined, there's 150,000 auto workers altogether for potential strikers, 362,000 is going to jump by quite a bit. Next up, big three profits. Need I say more? Ford, GM, Stellantis. 92% the profits have increased. We took a range of the years 2013 to 2022, $250 billion, okay? So that shows the amount of money that they are making. That's quite a lot. All right, let's take a look now at the U.S. wage growth. That is very important in terms of what we have for you. The top 1%, look how much increase they have had on their wages, 145%. That's a lot when you compare it to the bottom 90%, which is at 16% only for the wage growth the years that we looked at, 1979 through the year 2022. What do we have coming up next? CEO salaries. All right, that's the big one. That's one of the things that is up for discussion in a major way. The big three CEO salaries. You have Ford CEO Jim Farley, $21 million per year. Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares, $25 million. And the one that comes in at number one, Mary Barra, $29 million. The GM CEO. All right? Now, this is what hurts for the workers. The CEO profits were made $1.7 million off each worker, which came into the picture in terms of the way that these the CEOs made their profits, not in their salary, but in the time sharing that they did had with the profits. That's what it amounts to. Next up, what do we have? Car sales as a whole. How big a market is it? Vehicles and parts, $1.53 trillion. For the year 2022, okay? Tell me there's not a lot of money in car manufacturing. If there was to be an impact on that, the amount that it contributes to the U.S. GDP is 3%. So that's why this car strike is such a big deal. Still wait and see game to see if they're going to come up with any type of, agreements on this. All right, GM profits quarterly. This is as of the latest quarter. $3.2 billion they made, okay? And they still won't negotiate. The auto losses, however, $3.95 billion. You're looking at over a month and maybe a couple weeks now. That's how much money has been lost because of the strike. But that figure over there, that's a big figure there. I know, enough numbers. Let's go to our guests and see what they think about all of this. Let's bring back Daryl Mitchell, who's a retired auto worker. He worked at Chrysler Motors and also a former union representative who rejoins us. Daryl Mitchell, welcome back to Economic Divide. I'd like to find out from you why it is that it's not just auto workers that are striking. We're looking at other sectors that have joined now these strikes. It seems like the auto workers kind of set it off. I think it's because of the large numbers that are involved and how a major piece of the economy in the U.S. it plays. And this all points to stagnant wages and pay, basically. Why has it spread to other sectors, you think?
My view is that we're going through a fundamental change in the economy that is on the scale of the Industrial Revolution of the 18th century. We are going through a fundamental change in our society that's probably equivalent to the discovery of fire. I don't say that jokingly. Right now, I'm residing in San Jose, California. San Jose, California is like the home of the new technology. In the last century, Detroit and the auto industry was the home of technological innovation. My point is that we're going through a revolution in a technological complex on a scale that ushered in industrial capitalism. So we're talking about the destruction of the workforce as it had existed for the last 150, 200 years. We're going through a profound change in our society, and nothing can stop it or halt it.
Yeah, you know, he's got a point there, and I think he pointed out in the last time that we brought him on where the automation that took place in the car industry, which is one of the first to have gone that route,
pointing to the artificial intelligence that is going to be incorporated, and we're seeing obviously that to be applied in many industries. Let's bring in our guest, Diane Freely, retired auto worker and member of UAW, Local 22, see what she thinks. Diane Freely, I'd like to ask you the question I asked our previous guest, and that's about how we're seeing these strikes basically spread to other industries that we didn't expect. One of the most recent ones being Kaiser Permanente, which involves quite a number of employees. I think if you put it all together, about 80,000. But hospitality, tech industries, and even courier services. Why is that happening? I mean, you talk about only 3% inflation in the U.S. as it's reported, but yet people don't make enough money to pay their bills and to buy and basically to consume. What's happening?
Well, it's pretty widespread. And the minimum wage is very, very low, both the federal minimum wage and in Michigan, it's slightly higher. The federal minimum wage is about $7.50. The wage in Michigan is a little higher at $10 an hour. But even $15 an hour is not an adequate wage. So one factor is the low wages of many of the workers. The fact that inequality means that the profits are going much more towards the points that I raised before of CEOs, of outsourcing, of combining. You have corporations that not only are active as in one industrial area, but are conglomerates.
According to polls, more than 40% of U.S. voters who backed Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential election say they think that the economy is worse off than it was then. Rising gas prices and high interest rates have contributed to greater economic uncertainty and has dampened consumer confidence. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index fell for a second consecutive month, dropping to 103 in September from an upwardly revised 108.7 the month before. The decline in consumer confidence was evident across all age groups, and notably among consumers with household incomes of $50,000 or more. Share of consumers surveyed who believe a recession is somewhat likely or very likely rose in September after dropping in August. Consumer spending serves as a critical driver for U.S. economic growth. The U.S. Census Bureau's most recent Household Pulse survey for the 2 weeks ending September 4 showed that 80% of respondents were still somewhat or very concerned about future inflation. Annual consumer inflation dropped to 4% in May and 3% in June of this year, but came in at 3.2% in July and climbed to 3.7% in August.
I still worry very much that we could have a hard landing, whether, you know, probably not until next year. The hiking cycle that the Fed's been going through, it takes 12 months to 18 months for it to really have an impact on the economy. And same thing with the yield curve. The yield curve didn't invert till a year ago, and it usually takes about a year for it really to have that kind of impact.
Hello and welcome to the Quick Take section. I'm Matti Apposian. When it comes to the U.S. strikes, auto workers are not the only ones that are going on a strike. There are workers from other sectors like dining and hospitality, technology, and health services. Besides auto workers, hundreds of thousands of U.S. workers have walked off their jobs this year in industries of all types. This includes Hollywood screenwriters, Starbucks, Amazon workers, and frontline workers like nurses, hotel staff, and pilots.
This state is very expensive. I love where I'm from. I love my community. I love to be a part of this community. However, the going rate of a one-bedroom is $2,200.
The U.S. President Joe Biden, however, has stated that the U.S. economy is doing well, more or less, under the banner of Bidenomics, that Americans are just beginning to reap the rewards and have more confidence in the U.S. economy. In one survey, it's indicated that 44% of voters said they're worse off financially under Biden, the most for any president since Ronald Reagan in 1986. Let's look at some economic factors that go against Joe Biden's claims. For many Americans, job security is a big deal, and it should be, since U.S. businesses are not doing that well. U.S. business bankruptcies have reached a 13-year high. More than 450 corporations have claimed bankruptcy protection, surpassing annual totals for the past 2 years. The Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes and economic uncertainty